You're listening to Para X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Live and direct from my subterranean lair. My name is Ra, and I'm here to awaken the dormant particles that are spiraling inside your DNA. So come with me as we go further down the mystical spiral of life. It's Spiral Radio, where each and every week we unveil the different shades of you, the different shades of me, until we all vibrate the same frequency. I want to apologize, everybody. We're like 5 or 6 minutes late, and I want to say that it's the first time in this time we've been doing this show for a year that we actually were late. Something was wrong with the server, but Sarge, my producer, pulled it out because he's the master. Show enough. Sarge is the man. We got a great show tonight, and my guest, this is the Peter Moon Trilogy. My guest is Peter Moon, and this is the third time he's been on our show. And if you want to look Peter Moon up, and if you've never heard of him before, then you're in for a treat. You can go to timetraveleducationcenter.com. And if you want to find us at Spiral Radio, we're at themysticalspiral.com. And everybody, you know, this is going to go by real fast, so I want to just pretty much get right into it. The reason why I've asked Peter on tonight is we want to discuss what happens when we die. I mean, it's the question that we all think about. It's the question that's inside of all our minds as we get older. As when we're young, when we first understand or hear about death, it's the biggest mystery we've ever heard, you know, and going throughout all our lives, you know, everyone wants to uncover what's behind the veil of death. And I've picked Peter to discuss this because I feel that he's really has interesting takes on certain things. And I would love to hear his perspective on it and how this relates to maybe even ancient Tibet and ancient Egypt and all these other, you know, civilizations and cultures that were based around death being the reality. Even the Aboriginals saw death as the true reality and as this physical plane as sort of like not meaning as much as our dream time or our spirit time, who we are in the spirit form. So everybody, I want to welcome to Spiral Radio, Peter Moon. Nice to meet you, Peter. How's not to meet you, but nice to have you, Peter, again.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Yes. So, Peter, I'm sure you're familiar with the Bardo realms and what the Tibetan Buddhists call, you know, the Bardo realms and what happens when they die and how basically on when someone's on their deathbed, they're chanting to them mantras and explaining certain instructions of where to go, and when they see certain lights, what to do when they see these certain lights, and where they may lead to, and what beings they're going to encounter. And even I know when someone's on their deathbed, these monks are chanting silently for a little while, and then they'll let out a shriek at certain moments to open the sutures on the top of the head, so energies will go out to certain realms at certain times. And I was wondering what you have to add to this, and you think if it's sort of like how we are in this holographic universe in our astral plane and who we are in our spirit form, and is this some kind of soul simulation and life review? Do you believe that we're going towards these certain lights, and that certain lights, say if you led a certain life where you were always greedy and you were always some kind of glutton, then you'll get lured to the yellow lights where it goes to the hungry ghost realm or something like that. I'm wondering your take on this, Peter, and what you have to add to this.
Well, you know, this stuff has been, you know, I guess, written about in detail ad nauseum in Tibet. And then there's a different approach, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's actually called the Book of the Final Liberation. Considering death a state of liberation, it certainly is a liberation from the body. I wrote my own book, the Montauk Book of the Dead, with my experiences with not so much my own death, but my experiences with the phenomena of death as it entered my own life as my parents died when I was young.
Stop you right there for 1 minute. Now, that just sparked a memory I have of reading something of yours where you're submerged beneath the water and you found yourself in the clutches of a naked blue lady, and how you brought up that story from the Montauk Book of the Dead with that, and how this blue lady, you know, you were like in a lake with it was slimy and cold, although you didn't feel the cold. And tonight we can go down wherever the conversation takes us, because I want a casual conversation. I'm really intrigued by certain things that just come up spur of the moment. So when you said that, when you said the Montauk Book of the Dead, I thought of you in beneath a lake with that, in the clutches of a blue lady. So if you can possibly go there for a minute and explain.
That was a piece of, you know, literature that I wrote for the Montauk, you know, a preamble, but it's based upon, you know, my Celtic genetics and, you know, the Blue Lady of the Lake. And of course, it's metaphorical in terms of telling my story. Because when that book, the Montauk Book of the Dead, is written about a little over 10 years ago, but it was written a little over 10 years ago after I wrote all these books about Montauk. And then that book goes into how everything in my life, how I got involved in all of this writing about Montauk. And the death of my parents in 1974 was a very key point in terms of how it influenced my life. And it's a very long, involved story. But how it helped me in my experiences in my life, how I was able to deal with it, and how years later I was given these, you know, these mysterious clues that would lead to some sort of, I guess what you call reconciliation. Not that I wasn't reconciled, because I was not upset about it, but it's like when you die, when a person dies, they're physically gone. And I think the most, like, say, I just want to address what happens when we die. Well, you know what? Nobody really knows. There's all this, of course, the Catholics have their version. Different religions have their version. Certainly, Tibet has the suggestion that you can, you know, go through these bardos and you need all in this rigmarole. And then the Egyptians have this whole idea of continuity, living beyond death.
Well, even the Tibetans, like they will go around for some of their monks. They'll be looking through the crowd, trying to find when a baby's born, if the baby's going to point to the past one's old belongings or something. They'll go searching for the reincarnated soul as well.
Well, yes, and sometimes too much attention is put on this. In other words, what it is, death's a natural process. All of nature experiences death. So this idea of holding on to things is you know, not necessarily in the person's best interest, because, you know, when you die, you are in a, yes, a bardo state, but just because you died and went through a bardo hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, or think you did, when you die, it's just like, you know, you go to the first day of school. What's the first day of school? It's different. It's like not every, there's similarities. So when your experience in the human body comes to an end, well, the end is the beginning, and you have a new start. And of course, you've already brought up the idea of karma. The whole key in all of this is the present, which is the present. And the present is like, where are you? Now, death is also an intimidating process to most people, because they begin to lose their faculties. They begin to lose their memory. And the real key in all of this is the breath. The breathing is so important, because breath equals life. And this is what I've learned from Qigong. And when you die, you want to breathe. I will tell you a story of one of my fellow Qigong practitioners and students, who's also a Soji, which is a teacher of teachers. He's a very evolved soul in this regard. And he told me one of his teachers died. And I don't know if he witnessed it. I think he did, as I recall. But when the master died in front of all his students, and he did it with deliberate intent, and as his last breath, he took his last breath, and he kind of exclaimed, sort of a, you know.
Like a shriek, yeah.
It was a conscious exit of the body. Now, not everybody is, I mean, people die is many different ways.
You think he was doing that to open the sutures out of his head so the energy can go straight out?
Well, you know, you're describing that. I don't know what he did. I mean, he died with intent. And that's what's important.
Yeah.
He died with intent. And as they say, as many different ways as you can live a life, there are equal amount of different ways you can die. And how you die becomes a very individual thing. So it's like, and then where you go after you die is also an individual thing. So there's all sorts of stories, all sorts of accounts. There's the near-death crowd, near the OBE crowd, or the people that, like, I have many friends who have died clinically, and they come back with a gift.
Yeah.
And this is not that uncommon.
Yeah, no, I can relate, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, it's an individual thing. And you shouldn't evaluate it by what the Tibetans did. I mean, the Tibetans are very much into their own thing. And, you know, you shouldn't certainly evaluate it by how anybody. You have to evaluate it by who are you, what is your role. You can even muscle test somebody. Muscle testing is a legitimate way to diagnose and find out what a person needs, and you can apply this to the death state. You know, what do you need to know? Do you have to worry about karma? Do you have to worry about your relatives? Do you have to worry about, you know, the fact that you couldn't do this or that? So you have to, this is all about learning about the self. This is a very important issue, is learning about the self, who you are, what is your role, what are you to do. And what I noticed in my work and in my life, one of the biggest, I guess they say, deficiencies that people have, it's quite common, is that people aren't really certain of who they are, with the consequent results of them of their ideas being influenced or dominated by other people, and paying too much attention. People paying too much attention to what they say on the TV or what you were taught in school, and then fighting it and counteracting it. Who cares what they say on TV? Who cares what they said in school? It might have some validity, it might not, but why? You know, people have to fight these ideas that they disagree with or don't believe in. And if you're at peace with yourself, you'll be at peace with others. And I think this is a big deal, is to find peace within yourself, not necessarily, and then peace with others will follow, not try and make peace with, you know, the Christians or the Muslims or whatever it is that, that bothers a person. That's my...
I think that's it's an interesting take, and by saying, you know, breath is life is really strong, and I agree with the TV, you know, people shouldn't wonder, and it is an individual belief about what happens. Now, do you think, though, it's some kind of, we have some kind of soul matrix system? Because even us, my lineage, we get a lot of our lore and mythology from the Etruscans, and the Etruscans said they got it from the Persians, and Persians from like the star people or whatever, and it goes on like that. But the Etruscans, I know, passed it down to my family, and we believe that, you know, the soul, when it dies, it goes to the underworld first and then through the lunar realms. And that's why the Etruscans even started burying their dead in the ground on a hill, even, so they can look over the underworld portal as they go through the underworld and down and then back up through the lunar realm towards the lunar realms. And I think that's probably where we started burying our dead in the ground from, that belief, because I know that's where the Etruscans got it from. That's what they believed. They wanted the soul buried in the ground closer to the entrance to the underworld or to inner earth or wherever these portals or access to these alternate dimensions are. And I truly believe that there are access to these alternate timelines and alternate dimensions, to these portals that are surrounded by time gates or whatever you want to call them inside of Earth. And I think that Tibet has an entrance in Antarctica. And I really believe this, Peter. And I was wondering, we have a few minutes until our break at 8:30, if you could comment on that as well.
Comment on what specifically?
How there might be entrance ways to an inner Earth, and there might be portals to alternate timelines and alternate dimensions within Earth, and how the Etruscans even buried their dead.
Well, I heard all that. I'm just saying, you know, you set up, you know, the thing about, you know, the Berber people in Africa did, you know, built pyramids to, there were burial mounds. Burial mounds were pyramidal in Western Africa, in the Central Sahara. But basically, when people die, in the way people thought is completely different than it is now, there was not necessarily the disconnect that we have mentally with the dead. So the dead were honored. You also have Chinese ancestor worship. I know when my parents died in a car crash, I remember going to the family home, because I did not live at home, and I would feel my ancestors, not my parents. I would see Chinese lanterns, not that they were Chinese, but I would, the Chinese lanterns don't really necessarily come from China, but all this energy, I could feel my ancestors.
Yeah.
I could feel them, and that this was a very serious business. And, you know, my job is to carry forward the genetic line. But so there is not in ancient cultures such a disconnect. So the dead are honored. Now, recently, it's interesting that you mention this now, because I have been honoring the dead in my own life. It's like you pray for the dead and they will pray for you, so to speak. That's an old saying, an old song. But I have been, so when dead people come into my consciousness, people who have passed from this realm, I think about them and I honor them and I silently acknowledge them. You know, there's only so much, you know, all you can do is acknowledge them. You don't necessarily, you know, send them money or send them, you know, you just send them thoughts, consideration. And I have been returned by one of my dearest friends who passed away. I called her on her birthday last year. She was a very close friend for periods of my life. I'd not been in touch with her, Madeline Suozzo. She had healed me once. She was a healer, and we were very fast friends. And she passed away, cervical cancer. I didn't even know she had cervical cancer.
Wow.
I get kickbacks from her in the dream state more than anybody else.
Cool.
And we were very close. And I go, wow. And I see her in the dream state, and now I'm mentioning her on the air. It's like
I can almost see her now.
You're just like, wow. And you acknowledge and you develop a rapport. Now, communication can be, you know, you don't want to banalize it. You want to just say, okay, you just experienced this other thoughts. It could be your parents. It could be whoever's passed away in your life. And there's still a residue of them. There's still an energy. But the older people, the older civilizations did not break the continuity like we do today.
Yeah.
So this whole communication with the other realm. Now, that communication with the other realm is obviously they see other worlds. The Native Americans see things completely upside down to what the white person sees.
Yes.
In fact, it can be quite problematic in a cultural interface because they will just have complete disregard for this world.
You know, now that you say that too, I'm wondering, and probably we'll have to get to it more when we get back from break. Do you think it matters on what someone sees in their consciousness, how much melanin that they have in their brain? Because I know I was reading that in your book as well, and I thought that was very interesting. Am I saying that word right?
Melanin is, of course, identified in common, science as something which colors the skin.
Yeah.
This is a whole, that's about as far as it goes. And if you look up Wikipedia, you'll find, and I haven't looked at their definition lately, but they used to just go ballistic over the idea that melanin could be have any special properties to it, such as has been asserted. I mean, it's very interesting when you see Wikipedia go ballistic on something.
Yeah. Now,
it's ballistic, and you can read the undertone of who's writing it. And that's enough. But see, melanin is one of the most complex molecules that exists. And, of course, it's complicated. So, basically, melanin is that which makes a black person skin black from dark, or a brown person skin brown. A freckle is melanin. And the whole, in the Montauk Book of the Living, it's all about, it's not all about that, but it certainly includes the disease in the Bible. It's known as Zarat, which was called leprosy by the Greeks. Not the leprosy we know today, but it was called leprosy back then because it was a spotted skin condition. The leopard, like a leo was a leopard.
That's what you were saying. It was like copper-based, right?
No. It was a spotted skin. It's the copper base is, no, that's something else. The skin was spotted, and it was disease. These people had disease, and they were driven out of Egypt in the Exodus. There were three Exoduses.
I remember in the book, though, you were saying, like, the disease was a result of, like, the hybridization of copper-based blood or something,
yeah,
right?
But there were three Exoduses from Egypt. Tutmosis the IV being the most recent one, and he was identified as Moses in the Bible. Whether he is or not, wow, can be argued. Yeah. So these people were being kicked out of Egypt because of their skin condition, which was the result of, the most simplistic version is you had people with copper-based blood, Rh negative, which was a sort of Rh negative is really sort of a derivative of a copper-based blood. And the copper-based blood mixing with iron-based blood people, and the Rh negative occurs in all different races. But basically, you had people with a lot of melanin being in another race that was something like Vitiglio, however you say it. The doctor just pronounced it for me yesterday. And that's the spotted skin condition, which is basically these people were had this disease that the Bible called Zarat. And Zarat was the wrath of God is basically what it meant, because they were diseased and they developed inferior minds. And it was a, you know.
Like Zarat wrath, right? Wrath of God. That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah. So this is, but to get back to what you were saying about a soul matrix, a common template, and a common template for the soul matrix and the procedures you were saying is all based upon the Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah is a very not that well understood idea. But the Kabbalah, if you study it, and this is the great revelation that occurred through Aleister Crowley in his Book of the Law. And it is so interesting to watch all these people who were so-called experts in the occult. They will put down Crowley's book. Oh, it's this, it's that, including his own son and including the head of the temple of Set. The former head of the temple said, oh, this is, they don't even understand it. Aleister Crowley, and this is in the book of the Montauk Book of the Living, basically there are codes in that book which reveal that he was being downloaded by this IWAS creature, a template for DNA. It was very clearly explaining DNA and as it relates to the tree of life. And it's all explained in there. And the Kabbalistic tree of life that you'll see in any sort of book on the Kabbalah, including the Jewish books.
The Sephiroth, right?
But that's just one element of the tree of life, the Sephiroth, the sphere. This is all based upon, it's a metaphor for DNA.
Yeah.
DNA. So DNA goes through. Now, when somebody's doing a Kabbalistic template, they're trying to explain what goes on in DNA, and they are doing a good job of it or a not so good job of it.
There's like 10. Is there 10 or 11 Sephiroth? Something like that, right? There's 10. No. I think there's 10 or 11.
There's all sorts. There's at least 11, but there's all sorts of different theories about this, that, and the other thing. But these represent nodal points in the DNA, and it's very specific. I've written on it there. I've added some more information in the White Bat. And White Bat is sort of a advanced book because it really it really goes into deep into some of this stuff. But the Tree of Life, it's DNA trying to express itself. So you have the people doing Kabbalah are trying to express life. That's all they're doing. They're doing a good job of it or a bad job of it. And that good or bad analysis is depending upon your own inclination as a life form. But there's the K Kabbalah, which is spelled with a K, which is Jewish. The C Kabbalah, spelled with a C, which is Christian. And the Q Kabbalah, spelled with a Q, is Islamic. But there is also an Abala, which is much more rarefied, which is African Kabbalah. And that is based upon the template of getting into the vibrations of it. This is the work of Kenneth Grant, has done some work on this. Kenneth Grant is been relegated to becoming a very obscure author, although he's pretty, I don't know if his works can be found on the internet. The books are very expensive. I remember when I bought them 25 years ago, they were like $30 each, which is an expensive book, $32, $33. And now they've soared up in value. It's hundreds of dollars sometimes. But they might be online.
Well, we're going to take our break, Peter. And everybody, if you look in the sky and you will see there's a quickening upon us. And the shift of our consciousness on our planet allows us to tap into the oneness of all things easier. So make your spirit wake up from your hibernation and feel the quickening. Feel our planet and how her heart beats along with you and your excitement of feeling her heartbeat. You start to feel it beat even faster and faster. And your consciousness and the earth feeling beneath your feet, you start to wake from its deep sleep. And as the energy spreads across the world and seeds begin to bust and burst open in your consciousness and in the physical plane at the same time, simultaneously, leaves unfurl on trees and birds build their nests in them. And we connect with the flow of energy. And in this new moon that's coming tomorrow in Cancer, let you connect with new changes and energy and guide you in fecundity. And spiral out.
Anywhere. Thanks for making Para X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para X.
And we're back. My name is Ra, and this is Spiral Radio, and we are on the Para X Radio Network. And this tonight is we're transitioning into a new moon, and you can find our great guest at TimeTravelEducationCenter.com, and his name is Peter Moon. You can also find his books at Sky Books on Amazon and all those great places. And that lovely music you heard was My Good Buddies and Far Radio Clouds. The song was called Sonatas and Oversouls. And Peter, you know, it sparked a little conversation in the chat room here about melanin. And I was saying, you know, it sounds racist, but it's true that it's like more common in black people's skin, but more common in white people's brains. And even though it does sound like a little bit of racist sounding saying that, I was saying that that's kind of true.
No, that's not accurate. It's not true that it's more common in white people's brains
it's
than
more
in black
abundant.
People's
brains. I mean, more abundant.
It's no. The black no. That's
that's what I was reading in your book.
No, it does not say that. It does not say that. In other words, melanin is, I don't know how to describe it. It's it facilitates intelligence and consciousness, but it's in addition to being pigment. I mean, this whole book on it, African World Books, has, you know, is a great source. It's in Baltimore, Maryland. There's books on melanin, but basically, whole studies have been done on it. But the thing is, it does, because you have white skin, it means you're probably, let's say, much less than what you could be. This is the way Europeans evolved. They evolved into sort of a degenerate humanoid condition, which is what we live in today. We live in a degenerate society, and it's very easy to see. That doesn't mean that society's all bad. It doesn't mean that there's not good things in society. But when you look at the way people treat each other, the way the political system runs, it's not intelligently administered, okay? And so this is, you know, this is a humanoid type of a situation. It's not human beings. And it's probably worse in the United States in terms of, you know, and just the whole genocidal imperative. Okay. Now, you can have melanin in your brain without having it in your skin. So, in other words, you can have white skin and you can have a high concentration of melanin in your brain, but under no means do white people have more melanin than black people. That's just not, you know, I didn't say that. And of course, some black people have had very unfortunate situations by the circumstances they've lived into, and certainly have suffered. But there's been a whole persecution of the black race, the black people, that is outrageous. And it's of course, you don't get much compassion for it in a society that is predominantly still run with a white mindset, although it's more shifting more towards a gay mindset.
But is it true, though, what I'm saying is that they have considerably, like you said, that they have considerably like less in their skin, but they have an abundance in their brain, white people?
No, I don't mean that at all. I don't say they have an abundance of their... I never said that. In fact, I'd say the opposite. Obviously, they have some.
I'm not trying to call you out, Peter, but you're telling me I'm wrong, right?
And I think it's a ridiculous idea.
No, but you're telling me right, I'm wrong. I'm not trying to argue with you, but I have your book.
I think it's a ridiculous idea. I'm saying I thought you were quoting me.
No, I am, because on page 178 of the Montauk Book of the Living, I'm reading, it says, although white people have considerably less melanin with regards to their skin, they can possess an abundance of melanin in the brain.
They can.
That's what I was reading. That's why I just was asking about that.
That's the clarification. They can. Yes, you can have very intelligent white people. You can have. That is a possibility.
Okay. That's what I was saying, because you were trying to make me look like I just came up with this, but I was reading it from your book. You know?
Yeah, but I'm just clarifying what it said. It's fine.
Okay. No. I'm also interested in wondering that if this, you know, inner earth, and we see like the swastika And I know everybody talks about the swastika, but how Inner Earth, you know, might be some kind of underground civilization in there, and how the Hopi Indians were even using the swastika, and how the Nazis were using it, and ancient India, and all these places that have lore of these underground civilizations all have that use of the swastika. And I know that you were talking about the Black Sun and how that's even related to the swastika and the swirling vortex and everything as well. So I'm interested in your opinion on this Inner Earth, and if this is a possibility, or if what your, you know, what your take on it is as well.
Well, the swastika, and I, of course, researched the swastika for the book, The Black Sun. I did the Montauk's Nazi-Tibetan Connection. And the oldest book, and this is like, you know, recent literature I could find. In fact, it came through a loan, library loan. I think it came all the way from Albany. It's a book by Thomas Wilson, The Swastika, The Earliest Known Symbol and Its Migrations, by Thomas Wilson. And he goes, and this is written about, I think, about 1880s, and he demonstrates the ancient ubiquitousness of the swastika, ubiquitous meaning all over the place. Now, but what I've learned through my travels in Romania is that the swastika is an ancient symbol for their patron god, Zalmoxis, who initiated people in the Inner Earth. And the swastika is the symbol for Gemini. It's two twos.
Yeah,
you break a swastika into two twos, and it's the symbol for Gemini, and goes back to the age of Gemini, which goes back, you know, before the age of, we're almost in the age of Aquarius. Age, it goes back to Pisces, Aries, Taurus, and Gemini. That's thousands and thousands of years ago. And the swastika represented the twins, sign of Gemini.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way as well.
Yeah, this I learned in Romania. Gemini, and Gemini represented the twins, Apollo and Diana. Apollo, and they were both, of course, they show up in Greek mythology. They were borrowed by the Greeks. Diana might have been called, the Greeks called her Artemis. I don't know what she's called in the original Dacian language, but Apollo was recognized by the Greeks as a Hyperborean. And Hyperborea is, of course, means beyond the north. And it referred specifically to any area beyond north of the Danube, Hyperborea, because that's where the north winds were. But more specifically, it referred to Transylvania, which is sandwiched in the Carpathian Mountains. It's like a huge valley or crater or just a repository studded with, you know, caves, endless caves.
Gothic, very Gothic, yeah.
Well, that's where the Gothic comes from, the Jete, Gote, Jete, the Jete people. And the Gothic language has been, was basically destroyed. If you look up the conventional history, that they don't know what happened to the Gothic language. But it was a combination, from what I understood in Romania, of, if you look at Old German and Old Dacian, those two languages, Gothic would have derived, or would have gone into Old German and Old Dacian.
Wow.
So it's a very ancient language that was wiped out because they try to hide and obfuscate it, because there is so much, I guess what you'd say, knowledge and whatnot buried in it. And then they cover it up with this so-called Goth look, which has nothing to do with anything other than darkness.
So do you feel that these Hopi Indians, that they use the swastikas as well, that they maybe had some kind of contact with similar beings that people from Hindu religions and other religions contacted as well?
Well,
Hitler?
Well, the Hopis certainly, yes, they certainly are no exception to ancient peoples and their knowledge. And they have a word and it's in my book, the Montauk or the Pyramids of Montauk. I don't quite remember, but it's the moon. I think the Tibetan word for sun and moon were interchangeable with the Hopi word. So, in other words, sun meant moon, and moon meant sun. In other words, in those two cultures, Tibetan and Hopi. So that was very interesting. So all of these, and the very ancient connections between Tibet and Romania, they all go back to a blue race. The blue race, this is also a feature in the Montauk Book of the Living. The blue race, you would see the ancient Lama was blue. The ancient Atlantean goddess Antinea was blue.
Do you think that like Lemuria had a race of blue people, like with four arms and...
I can't speak for Lemuria, but certainly it would be stand to reason. But
I think I read about it in Blavatsky's book. It was like the third root race or something. She called it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know my root races by heart. But anyway, the ancient queen of Atlantis, Antinea, these people, the sorceress was called a Kahina. Now they were. This is blue. This is why the people in the Africa, the Algeria area primarily, the Ahaggar are the blue people, the Tuareg, who have this ancient tradition of coming from a blue goddess. And then you have the Kahina, which is like the Kahuna, and it's the same root word in Hawaii, but you also have the Kachina.
Kachina, yeah, the Hopi
this
spirit.
Would come from the southwest, the blue Kachina.
Yeah.
So you see, you have this consistency in the etymology, which would trace back to a blue race of copper-based blood people that had all of considerably more faculties than we have today and would have a high content of melanin. This is all theoretical. It's theoretical. It's hypothetical, but it all makes perfect sense. So we're working with and the human body is a very challenged, in some ways it's very remarkable, but it's also a very challenging situation to wake up and grow up in a human body, because obviously you're presented with many challenges in life.
I know they had a blue, the Hopi have a blue Kachina prophecy that it was going to bring the great purification on the world, you know, the blue Kachina. And I think Kachina in Hopi just means spirit as well, but they use it for a lot of different terms as well, like the red star Kachina, the blue star Kachina. There are a lot of their prophecies that are related to Kachina. They even have Kachina dolls.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're all of these ancient peoples, you know, you could say that they, if they don't come from the same source, it's sort of like if you took a bunch of people, like if you have a bunch of Americans and you're in a foreign country somewhere like China, you're going to find a lot of commonalities in those Americans, even if they're of a non-traditional American descent. If they, you know what I mean? They might be Hispanic Americans. They might be Black Americans. They might be Chinese Americans, but if they're all basically American and grew up in American schools, you're going to find a lot of commonalities with those Americans if they're all sitting together in China or they're all sitting together in Germany, and they can relate to each other better than they might relate to each other if they were in the United States. So this is what you have when you go back into ancient peoples. They were all living in a time when mankind was in a different state of mind than we are today, but it was quite, you know, similar amongst each other.
Yeah, I feel too that it's possibly that we've been living in the end times, the apocalypse. It could have been ever since Columbus came over here to the New World and, you know, started taking land by force, that ever since then we've already been living in the apocalypse, and we're probably going to maybe even see America fall in our lifetime. Who knows?
Well, the true apocalypse, the word means the uncovering of the goddess, uncovering of Calypso. Calypso was a goddess who appeared in the Odyssey. Calypso. But the goddess, the apocalypse rather, the end times occur for every one of us at a different time. There's this idea that it's all going to occur simultaneous. But we're each going to meet our end at a certain time. And it's very unique for the individual. Yeah, there might be collective happenings going on. There are always collective happenings. But the thing we have to be most concerned about is our own journey and our own pathway.
I agree. That's beautifully said, too. And, you know, people can find you at Time Travel Education Center as well as Sky Books, right? As well. And you're coming up on your 25th.
I want to say the website for skybooksusa.com. If people want books, skybooksusa.com. And the Time Travel Education Center is the most important website that I've done. And that has a whole series of videos that explain the math and science of time travel in a very easy to understand format.
And you can find Peter at Time Travel Education Center, like you said, and you can also find his books on Amazon, and you can find us at themysticalspiral.com. And, you know, you're coming up on the 25-year anniversary of Experiments in Time?
Yeah, that was in May, the 25th silver anniversary of the Montauk Project Experiments in Time. It's 25 years old.
Wow, and I remember that was one of the first times I heard of you, you know, it was from that book. And that Montauk chair diagram always stuck in my head, too. And I was always wondering that if this was possibly an inner earth technology from, you know, some off-world entities that are kind of like occupying inner earth, and maybe the Nazis or in Germany got a hold of it, and that's how it ended up on Montauk, you know?
Well, it's definitely an unconscious, negative consciousness experiment that was done to override the more pristine energies of the inner earth. Now, the inner earth can be viewed as having dark and light. This is the whole idea of duality. But dark energies, light energies, the yin-yang symbol, it all applies. And certainly, the first two of my psychic friends told me when I first got involved in the Montauk Project, before there was a book, they said, you're getting involved with the inner earth. That was what they told me. And now these things come to fruition in more recent years with what's breaking through in Transylvania. As a matter of fact, I was just signing the dotted line today on a contract it's already under translation, the fifth book in the series, the Transylvania series by Redu Sinemar, which is called Inside the Earth, the Second Tunnel. It is all about the inner earth and is written to, I guess, clarify people's perception of the inner earth, because it's not necessarily what people think. And I haven't completed the book myself, but it's very much dedicated to the inner earth. That's what it's about.
I've been fascinated my whole life when I first heard about Admiral Byrd, you know, many years ago. So, you know, I would love to have you back on another time to talk about that and what Radu wrote about and all that. So, like I said, everybody, this is the great Peter Moon, and you can find him at Time Travel Education Center. And this is all the time we got for now. Stay tuned for the next show. Power X Radio always brings you great shows and great topics. We're going to say goodbye to now. I want to thank Sarge. I want to thank Peter Moon, everybody in the chat room, everybody out there listening. Thanks for dealing with us at the beginning. We were a little late, but we appreciate it. And Spiral out.